Last week, the Court of Appeal gave its eagerly awaited decision in the combined appeals in Dreamvar v. Mishkondorea and P&P Property v. Owen White and Catlin. There are two cases that illustrate the dangers of property fraud and raise the question, who should be liable for the losses of innocent victims? We have Owen Talfin Davies, partner at Field Fisher, here to analyse the decision in the latest episode of On the Case. Owen, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
In simple terms, what was the issue raised by these two cases of Dreamvar and P&P?
First of all, I think it's worth considering the common facts to the both cases. In both cases, a fraudster posed as an owner of a registered property and instructed solicitors and agents to act for him on the sale of the property. Genuine purchasers were then found, and the purchasers instructed their own solicitors in their acquisition. Contracts for sale and completion of the property were completed in accordance with the Law Society's Code for Completion by Post, commonly referred to as the Code, and the fraud was only discovered after completion, but before registration of the properties at Land Registry, and at a time when the fraudster had disappeared and made away with the proceeds of sale. Mm-hmm. Dreamvar and P&P therefore concern the claims of the victims against third parties to recover the proceeds of sale in circumstances where they could not call upon the fraudster, the monies having disappeared away. So in Dreamvar, the purchaser brought claims against his solicitors, Mishkondorea, both for negligence and for breach of trust. He also brought claims against his vendor's solicitors, i.e. the fraudster's solicitors, for breach of warranty of authority, breach of an undertaking, breach of trust, and also, but rather late in the day, a claim in negligence as well. And in the P&P case, the purchaser, i.e. the victim of the fraud, didn't bring a claim against his own solicitor, but he brought claims against his vendor solicitors, again for breach of warranty of authority, breach of undertaking, breach of trust and negligence. And also he brought a claim against his selling agents, Winkworth, for breach of warranty of authority and negligence.
So basically the real key point is, when it all goes wrong due to a fraudster, who's going to end up footing the bill? That seems to be the main thrust of what the case is concerned.
Indeed, and all of those parties are in course insured, which was a key point which we'll come on to discuss.
Yes, and the position as it stood after the High Court decisions, particularly that in Dreamvar, had a lot of people concerned, didn't it? Can you outline what those issues of concern were?
I think it's fair to say that many practitioners considered both decisions in the first instance to be wrongly determined. And to that end, it's perhaps worth considering the breach of trust claims specifically and how they arise. The concept is quite simple. The purchaser pays to his own solicitors the completion monies in preparation for completion of the transaction. A trust relationship arises in that regard. The purchaser's solicitor holds the completion monies on trust for his client, and he's to use those monies solely for the purpose of completing the property transaction. In addition, most practitioners pre-P&P and Dreamvar were of the view that the trust relationship, or a trust relationship, also arose when the purchase solicitors paid the completion monies to the vendor's solicitors, who equally should be deemed to hold the completion monies on the same basis, i.e. solely for the purposes of completing the property transaction. Accordingly, when completion does not take place, and it cannot take place because a fraud has been perpetrated, a genuine sale doesn't take place, and therefore both the purchasers and the vendor solicitors will be in breach of trust. The trust monies have been used for something other than for the purpose of completing the property transaction. However, in the first instance decisions in both Dreamvar and P&P, the court said that the Law Society's Code for Completion by Post, which had been adopted in both transactions by the conveyancers, intervened. The code at paragraph 10 requires the vendor's solicitors to pay the monies away to the vendor on completion. So what the vendor solicitors argued in the case in first instance and at the Court of Appeal was that this imposed upon them a strict obligation once they received the completion monies to pay it away to the fraudster, and that therefore no trust relationship arose. That was the decision in the first instance cases, and the court agreed with the vendor solicitors and didn't find them liable. And most commentators felt that decision was simply wrong, on quite a simplistic basis, because completion did not take place. So the Law Society's code shouldn't intervene. Since completion did not take place, the vendor solicitors had no authority under the code or otherwise to release the monies held to their fraudster, and in those circumstances should be held to be in breach of trust. And so in answer to your initial question, and why the Dreamvar decision had a lot of people concerned, was on the basis that in the decision of first instance, the court held that the purchaser solicitors, Mishcon, were liable for breach of trust, but the vendor solicitors were not so liable. And on the facts of that case, the vendor's solicitors appeared to be far more culpable for the loss suffered. So it's of no great surprise that the Court of Appeal has overruled the earlier decisions and quite rightly determined that absent a valid completion taking place, the code will not intervene and absolve the vendor's conveyancer of liability for breach of trust.
Now the Court of Appeal, as you say, has decided the combined appeal. And how far have they gone in addressing the concerns that were there?
Well, I think they've certainly addressed the concerns in as much as they've clarified the situation that both solicitors will now be in breach of trust. And that has clarified a great deal of the uncertainty that arose from the decisions of first instance. The Court of Appeal has also indicated that neither of the solicitors would be entitled to any relief arising from the liabilities from breach of trust. And it's probably worth considering this point further. Because relief can be granted to a trustee who's in breach of his duties under Section 61 of the Trustees Act 1925. And relief can be granted where the trustee has acted honestly, has acted reasonably, and he can show that he ought fairly to be excused from liability. But generally, there's a strict approach to liability when one is dealing with professional trustees, as we have here with the purchasers and vendor solicitors. In the P&P case, the Court of Appeal was not willing to grant relief to the vendor solicitors for its breach of trust. The Court of Appeal held that the solicitors did not act reasonably, and there was a series of failures on their part to carry out a number of relatively basic checks to identify their client, and which could have prevented the fraud from occurring. In Dreamvar, no relief was granted to Mishcon Dorea, the purchaser's solicitors, notwithstanding the court held that they had acted honestly and reasonably. The court went on to say that there's a balancing exercise that must be undertaken, and taking into account the relative effect or consequences of the breach of trust, it was apparent that Mishcon, with or without insurance, was far better able to meet and absorb the liabilities than its client at Dreamvar. It's also not irrelevant that Mishcon Dorea was necessarily far better placed to consider and as far as possible achieve the protection for Dreamvar against the risk. Some practitioners may consider that determination to be a little bit harsh, and indeed Lady Justice Gloucester actually sided with Mishcon on that point in a dissenting judgment. The Court of Appeal also looked at the other claims, of course, and held that there wasn't any liability for negligence on the part of the vendor solicitors or indeed the selling agents Winkworth in the P&P case, solely because there was no duty of care, either assumed or otherwise, as they were not acting for and on behalf of the purchaser, i.e. the victim of the fraud. What is a somewhat unsatisfactory outcome of these cases, however, is that there is no actionable duty imposed upon the vendor solicitors to comply with its AML obligations, and an omission to do so will not give rise to any liability. And I consider that to be quite an unsatisfactory position, not least as a number of these claims arise by virtue of the vendor solicitors' failure to do that. Then finally, the court did consider the two other claims, breach of warranty of authority and breach of an undertaking. In relation to breach of warranty of authority, the Court of Appeal held that the vendor solicitors had breached their warranty of authority, as they said they acted for the seller, when in fact they did not. But the court held that there was no reliance placed upon those statements, and therefore the breach of warranty of authority claims did not succeed or give rise to any liability. However, the breach of undertaking claims did succeed, and here again the Law Society's code for completion by post did intervene, because paragraph 7 of that code contains an undertaking on the part of the vendor solicitors that they undertake that they have the seller's authority to receive the purchase monies. And the Court of Appeal held that the seller, for the purposes of the code, means the real owner and not the fraudster, such that the vendor's breach of undertaking applied in those circumstances.
So moving beyond these two cases, can you summarise for us what the position now is following the Court of Appeal's ruling? It sounds like the safety net for the victim has been reinforced somewhat.
Definitely, the safety net has certainly been reinforced for the victim, and they now have certain means of recovery where monies can't, of course, be recovered from the fraudster, which, of course, is the first method by which recovery should be sought. I think one of the most important things to think about from this case is, of course, that it applies to all transactions where solicitors are dealing with client monies and not just in relation to property transactions. So as regards the breach of trust claim, it's going to have much wider implications. As regards conveyancing specifically, there are a number of points on which we can consider.
Yeah, so how do you think conveyancing solicitors will need to react to this decision? Will they need to change the way they operate to best protect themselves?
Well, I think the most important thing, if we all take a step back in relation to these cases and to look at the facts, and when one looks at the facts, there are very strong grounds to say that if the vendor solicitors had fully complied with their anti-money laundering regulation duties and also had due regard to the Law Society and Land Registry's practice note on fraud and red flags one might look out for, which would indicate a potential fraudulent transaction. When one takes those two duties and takes them to full effect, I think in these cases it's more than arguable to say that if the vendors, conveyancers had followed their duties in that regard and had due regard to the current guidance notes that are available to practitioners, the frauds may well have been detected and prevented. So first and foremost, I think this case is all about warning practitioners as to what their duties entail before one then goes on to consider how liability arises and how it should be vested for breach of trust, for example. So I think that the most important point is for solicitors and conveyancers to be alive to the Law Society and Land Registry's practice note on fraud, and also to ensure they fully comply with their AML obligations, i.e. their anti-money laundering obligations. In terms of conveyancing transactions itself, I think it's quite conceivable that a purchaser solicitor will now want to ask the vendor solicitors to give a warrant of authority that they act for the true owner of the property, and also to reinforce the undertaking given at paragraph 7 of the code, so that they can rely upon the vendor solicitors' assurances that they are acting for the real owner. I suspect it's likely that the vendor solicitors will not provide those assurances, and in those circumstances it may be for the purchaser solicitors to look at obtaining additional fraud insurance, which would cover off their own risk as well as their client's risk if the transaction proved to be one which was being affected by a fraudster.
You mentioned insurance, that's something you said earlier that had been relevant, certainly, or seen to be relevant, certainly with the first instance decisions in this case.
Well, absolutely. And of course, as I said at the outset, all of the parties or the defendants to these cases were, of course, fully insured, mm-hmm. Which was one of the main reasons why the court held that liability should vest with them and not for the innocent mm-hmm. victim of the fraud. Although in certain circumstances, I think one might readily say that the solicitors themselves are the innocent victim of the fraud, and indeed their insurers. And that is probably one of the more unsatisfactory aspects mm. of the decision. But I think it's, as I say, I think there could be an emergence of a specific fraud insurance market arising from these cases in circumstances where the vendor solicitor is unwilling to provide the assurances which the purchaser can rely upon, and in circumstances where the purchaser wants to cover off all known risks.
So where do you think we go next? Do you think there is much likelihood of these cases being considered by the Supreme Court? And would we still benefit from the kind of definitive ruling on these issues that the highest court could give?
I'm not necessarily sure. Obviously, it's worth noting, as I said earlier on, that Lady Justice Gloucester dissented and said that Mishcon Dorea, as the purchaser's solicitors in Dreamvar, should not be liable for breach of trust, in as much as they should be granted relief under Section 61 of the Trustees Act. And that aspect could lead to an appeal by Mishcon Dorea in respect of their liability. However, I think that claim may be better dealt with by way of a contribution claim between both firms of solicitors, where at the moment they are both jointly and severally liable to the for the victim's losses. But it would seem to me that, as has been clear on the facts, that the more culpable party is the vendor solicitor in that case. So whether that question is best determined by the Supreme Court, I consider it might be better dealt with by way of a contribution claim. But we wait and see. The parties have 28 days in which to lodge their applications.
And obviously you mentioned sort of the headline point is that solicitors should refresh themselves as to what the guidance requires of them and what best practice involves, and certainly what the anti-money laundering sort of regulations require them to do. But do you think the industry would benefit for some updated guidance on best practice in order for solicitors to protect themselves in the light of these rulings?
Well, I think the Law Society and Land Registry's guidance notes is already out there. Mm-hmm. And if anything, the case should simply remind practitioners of that guidance. And the guidance is very helpful indeed, and if followed to the latter, probably would have identified the mm-hmm. fraud in these cases. I think it's essential that the vendor solicitors comply with their AML obligations, and it's unfortunate that the court has essentially reached a determination that no cause of action arises from a vendor's solicitor's failure to do that. I think the Law Society's Code for Completion by Post may well come under some scrutiny and require some updating. And certainly I think a number of conveyancers will wish to avoid adopting the code going forward because of the strict liability that can arise pursuant to its adoption. But I think one thing I would say, these cases highlight the fact that conveyancers are not necessarily always alive to some of the issues that crop up. And it's a stark reminder that the costs of conveyancing have been driven down very much in recent years. And the importance of which it is for a conveyancer to carry out the transaction with reasonable skill and care, and sometimes in such a cost-sensitive sector of the legal industry, that perhaps is not always adhered to as one would hope.
So, in short, though a painful one for those involved in the case, it's a very valuable lesson for all operating in the industry, isn't it?
I think that's right. obviously, it is worth noting, and there are a number of headlines arising from this case, but frauds are not altogether that commonplace. Mm-hmm. And the evidence would appear to indicate these frauds and other similar frauds have been perpetrated by the same fraudster or fraudsters. Whilst there are a number of headlines, as I say, arising from the case, I think in the fullness of time, once insurers realise the extent of their liability, as against other liabilities arising under professional indemnity insurance policies, this may not be seen as giving rise to such significant risks as has been reported to date. But we'll only have to wait and see in that respect. But I think the case does underline the risks of fraud, and hopefully this case and the prominence of reporting in relation to it will actually serve to detect and prevent frauds of a similar nature.
Fingers crossed. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Owen.
Thank you very much.